I may start with one question, and which I would like to address to any of the presenter. Maybe starting with the FELDS data, because you were saying that your cohort was just about just for looking at heterogeneity. And as we know, when we develop modeling, one of the things that we want to know is where are sources of heterogeneity and what are the sources that matter in creating the outcome of your system. So if I am to ask each of you presenter this morning, what would you see in the systems that produce obesity, BMI, and other diet-related disease, what are the sources of heterogeneity that are out there and that that matters in accounting for the outcome, or that matters in designing how to change this outcome? You can take your turn at the mic there.
I think the source of heterogeneity, maybe I could start by saying these are people born starting in 1929, and over years there have been policy change or lifestyle change. We start with Great Depression, and then World War I, II, and then we become very prosperous, and now we are in an economic downturn. So these are the heterogeneity of the environment. And also, the FELDS participants are majority white. Back then, it's very difficult to recruit population other than white. You know, Tuskegee event. So I actually visited Tuskegee. They don't have any human studies. So that is a severe drawback in terms of our study. And then also the heterogeneity, it's also related to familial situation. I think there's certainly some genetic differences in terms of obesity. Obesity probably related more on the environment, but I would say gene and environment interaction, because from the data at FELDS, we show that some families tend to be more obese overall compared with other family. Also, this is compounded with the year of birth of the secular trend issue. So, and another point I want to make is the measurements issue. I think we tend to think about large data sets and think about huge data merging, data mining issue, but measurements is a big problem in terms of merging various data. I think we have to be very careful about not just the measurement technique per se, it's also how we name the measurements. Sometimes we call waist circumference, sometimes we call abdominal circumference. These are two different things. They could be different by centimeter, 3 centimeter. And also another issue is the use of the measurement per se. I've seen in the literature using BMI for infancy. You know, infant cannot stand. We measure recumbent length for infancy, but they take the weight divided by recumbent length squared. You can imagine how large the errors in measuring recumbent length in infant. And then you square in the denominator. So that is a big error. So then you sometimes underestimate the prevalence of obesity or overestimate it. So I think the source of heterogeneity, there's a lot of it. And, of course, Western world is very different from the east side of the countries and of the globe. So I don't know if I addressed your questions, but I certainly attempt to.
The other presenter, I'd like to hear a bit your source of the originality from each of your perspective.
So So I just want to make a comment that to follow up that, you know, is an excellent point that noise or measurement error is going to make it very difficult to compare populations, and this is going to be an issue for some of the modeling approaches that will be discussed this afternoon. I think, in particular, agent-based modeling is really requires clean parameters, and this is challenging to identify. So. And the problem I see it, as I see it, is there's a trade-off between sociological and contextual richness and biological precision in measurements. So the study I described, ALSPAC, is much richer than most biomedically oriented studies in sociological and contextual data, but still does not have the depth of sociological information, and in particular the dynamic network data that's available in AdHealth. AdHealth, on the other hand, relied on a lot on self-report rather than objective measurement. And if you're talking about a questionnaire or an exam that may take several hours, then adding in a lot of extra biological measurement is going to be burdensome and affect your retention and participation rates. So I'm not saying I have a solution to it. I just want to raise that issue and open it up for others to perhaps comment.
I think one of the issues I'd like to really address in terms of heterogeneity is really something that came out of the presentation I made earlier on about rural and urban adults. There is the issue that you raised about waist circumference, and I think one of the important considerations that the WHO expert consultation spent a lot of time on was insisting that the measurement needs to be standardized and looked at the level of error that appears if you measure it at the level of the umbilicus. Or there are, I was surprised to note that they were even measuring just above the superior iliac crest and assuming that was the point at which the abdominal circumference should be measured. So these considerations have to be taken, and clearly methodology has to be established and standardized across when you're looking at differences. You also mentioned the whole issue of differences in adiposity, and I think this is something that is quite old. We know for a long time that different population groups have different levels of adiposity for the same body mass index. And one of the problems with the Asian population is the fact that for a given BMI, which is much lower than populations in the West, the Caucasians in the West, is that the proportion of fat is much more for a comparative BMI. The second important thing is, where is this adiposity deposited? Is it generalized, or is it within the muscle or in the abdominal region? And that's another important source of heterogeneity that contributes to increased disease risk. And clearly these have to be taken into consideration. And I think one of the advantages of the longitudinal studies that you're conducting, clearly with the wide range of biological parameters, is the fact that you cannot do that in cross-sectional studies. You cannot achieve that level that you can do when obtain data on longitudinal studies, because there's a lot more investment. It includes much smaller populations, unlike when you can do it on a cross-section on a much bigger population base. But clearly there are numerous advantages, and I think the interactions between environment can be picked up. Now, going back to this whole issue of, I think you talked about migration. I mean, and I think migration mustn't always be looked at from the point of view as international migration. A good example is what happens to the South Asian diaspora. People from the Indian subcontinent, whether they're from Pakistan, India, Sri Lanka, are from Bangladesh and they move to the West. And you notice that their risk, cardiovascular disease risk increases threefold. Their increase of diabetes increases, I don't remember the exact risk ratio, but it goes up more than twofold. And it happens despite the fact that they are not as obese, nor do they have an abdominal obesity as much as the indigenous population, either in the UK or in the US. Earlier, many of these studies were carried out in the UK, and you could see comparisons between South Asians and the local UK population, and it was shown that South Asians had a much higher risk of cardiovascular disease and diabetes mellitus. Now, we think of it as international migration. I think it's a whole issue of migration here, because you see the same features appearing when people migrate from rural India to urban India. You notice that the risk of cardiovascular disease and diabetes mellitus is much higher in urban India as compared to rural India. So migration is a word that should be used across the board for both international and rural to urban migration. And there was this fascinating study that was done in Kenya, in Nairobi, where they were following up people who moved less than 90 kilometers into Nairobi, and within 18 months they had higher blood pressures, increased risk of obesity within 18 months. So clearly the change in the environment can be so dramatic, and it creates a lot of changes, and you can see that whatever predisposing risk these people had were expressed when they moved into this environment. So we need to look at it. I don't know how to actually get it sorted out in my mind, because is it entirely genetics, or is it something that some people have certain predispositions which may have been environmentally imposed? For instance, we know now that low birth weights increase risk. We know that socio-cultural factors increase risk. So we are not talking about genetics itself. In low birth weight, for instance, people are wondering whether it is epigenetics that is responsible for it. We don't know. Clearly, there are changes in the environment. And I think what needs to be considered very carefully when we are looking at developing countries is the fact that these changes are occurring in such short spans of time frames. You know, you look at changes in the food system. If you ask somebody, how long did it take for the present supermarket retailing system to emerge in the U.S.? And they'd say about 90 years. And this very same process has occurred in Brazil in 15 years. So you notice that the whole time frame of these changes, dramatic changes, are so shortened that these countries are going to be at increased risk of numerous factors operating. And how we are going to separate this out? And clearly, I think the effort that the Foresight group did in trying to just disentangle obesity is a good model to work on, because these countries are operating under several different problems. The problem of the linkage between undernutrition and overnutrition. We know, for instance, data from Brazil that stunted children are at increased risk of obesity. Whether it is in China, whether it's in Brazil or Mexico, stunted children have a greater risk. There is good evidence that stunted children secrete a lot more of steroids when you enforce some sort of intelligence test on them, or a cognitive psychological test on them. So clearly there are changes that occur as a result of maybe nutritional insult. It's not genetics, but these individuals are different, and therefore they will respond differently to an environment. And unless we can model them all together into this, taking into consideration the situation, which is quite different from what we see in the West, it's going to be very difficult for us to understand what's happening.
So I want to push us a little bit here and think about something. It's related to a lot of the comments that have been made. So if we think about the conversation this morning, you, Laurette, pushed us this morning to be thinking about intervention and about how we're going to really solve this problem. And if we think about the data that we've heard about, and we think about multiple levels, all the way from gene to the individual, up through family, worksite, community, and then to region, all of the studies that we heard about this morning, the unit of investigation is the individual, and we go down to try to understand the diversity of the individual, and we ask the individuals mostly, there's some variations on this theme, what their context is that they live in, what are the parameters of that context, and we get probably a fair amount of perceived contextual information. But we know that intervening at the level of the individual, for the most part, has not been necessarily that productive, and that we need to intervene at a level up from that, at the level of the family, of the school, of the worksite. And yet we haven't heard of any studies where the unit of investigation is the worksite or the family or the school. I know we're going to get a little bit of that tomorrow when Steve talks, but we're starting, I think, with the data sets in a way in the wrong place. And what worries me when we start to think about the modeling that we associate with these data sets is we're going to again start at the level of the individual and try to go up and down from that. And when we think about that, I think a lot of the contextual information we can get about the context that individuals live in, it's going to come from layering of different kinds of information, say from GIS or other sources, and then situate people where they are. But we're going to quickly run into some big problems about the kind of data that we collect from individuals and the gap in data that we have at the level where the unit might be the family or the worksite or the school, or at the level of the community and community policies with respect to certain kinds of physical structures or whatever they are. And so I think we need to start getting our heads wrapped around how we can get better data where the level of intervention, in a sense, is the focus of attention and is the unit of understanding, and a little less about the individuals. There's going to be problems in comparing cohorts and stuff like that in terms of things like BMI because of different measures. But for the most part, we've got hugely rich data sources already about diversity at the level of the individual down and to some extent up. But I think we may be not focused in the right place when we want to intervene at the level of schools or work sites or communities. And we need more relevant policy and contextual information from those levels. So it's a little bit of a philosophical statement, but I think it's one of the things that's going to be a problem for us. So I'll give you a quick example. We're in my lab working on an agent-based model of the built environment in two neighborhoods in Vancouver, and we have great rich data from a cohort study about individuals, and we had a student who had done a very detailed audit of the built environment. But one of the things we learned, for example, is that most of the questions we ask about physical activity of the individual, we don't actually separate out whether they do their activity in their home environment or their work environment. And so immediately we have trouble applying the kinds of data that we're collecting to those sorts of assessments. And we don't know what people do, how they make their decisions moving in those environments as well. So, and we don't have a lot of data about the built environment and the policies that shape, or not even policies, the decisions that people make when they shape their own physical environment. So,
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, but I fully agree. I'm Roy Sabo from Virginia Commonwealth University. I do know the first problem from an analytic point of view in that frame of mind, even though I again agree with it. Depending on the type of next level of analysis you want above the individual, it might not be feasible to do so. Most cluster randomized trials, which would be required in such a case, require many groups, not 10 or 20, but more, in order to be adequately powered. If we're talking schools, that might not be feasible. If we're talking cities, that might not be feasible. However, if in certain cases, like families, that might be much more attainable. So I think the level of that next hierarchy up is going to be key. If it's a small level, if it's not too high up from an individual, maybe it's feasible we can do it now, maybe with some of the data sets that we've seen. But if we want that to be much more general in that hierarchy, it's going to take more of a concerted effort and a cooperation between funding agencies and researchers.
Yeah, but it doesn't always have to be cluster randomized trials to get the empirical data about what's going on. I mean, why aren't school administrators, for example, a target audience for understanding what happens in schools? And there is some of that work done, and Steve will talk about it tomorrow. Or people at work sites who make decisions about food environments or physical activity environments, why aren't they the subject of the people that we're trying to understand these environments, or urban planners and, et cetera?
I don't know if Hedridge or some other person wants to talk about the Ad Health, where the school administrators are actually part of the sample that are, and that's...
And SHAPES does that, too. So I thought Ad Health was one of the few that went in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, not to be defensive, and I just want to... It looks like today all the presentation this morning are for observational study. There is no intervention involved, for one thing. And then two, I think the longitudinal data depends on what kind of data you collect. So since it's not an intervention trial, so you can look at it as whether there's a family component, there is a community component. You can structure in such a way that you can look at, in addition to individual level, you can look at the family level. In fact, that's what we are trying to do right now with Roy Sable and the other two or three people from Commonwealth, Virginia. But I do want to say, though, I'm not familiar with agent-based modeling, and I'm eager to learn. but my real concern, and it's not about aging-based modeling or any modeling. My real concern is it's great to have a lot of psychosocial data that we can use and to mine the information from the data. I just wanted to go back to the basic also that just to remind everybody, we're talking about obesity. Yes, there may be energy expenditure, energy intake, and there are also variable, like we may not have the data to look at. Or if we have the data, it's not ideal. For example, what is whether the sexual maturation, the timing of sexual maturation that affect obesity or obesity affect early sexual maturation? Nowadays, we're looking at in the Fels girls, some girls at 10 years old would have their menstruation. And where years ago, the FAERS participants' menarche age is about 12.3. So there is this secular trend changes. So I think it's great we have psychosocial data, and it's also wonderful that we have biological data. I think the issue is how do we merge these sets of different data set together where the model, the result of model wasn't affected by tremendous data happen in a psychosocial small amount of data in biology or vice versa. I think we wanted to, because when you have a majority data from one aspect, let's say biology, this data gonna dilute the importance of the psychosocial data and vice versa. So I do want to point it out, they are intervention trials that we have in Virginia, Commonwealth University, such as Teens Project, where we still intervene at the individual level, although the family is a part of the intervention and the parents a part of intervention. So there are right now three levels of interventions. And we have not gone so far to the school base because of the funding issues. We hope we have someone like Samuel Fels to support our study of this kind, don't we? Especially when we are in an economic downturn. But I would say there are school-based studies funded by NIH over years, for example, the CATCH study. But I think they do find, they're school-based. I say,
If I can make a remark, I think philosophically agreeing with
I think
maybe to state the obvious, is that the term unobserved, or the description unobserved heterogeneity, has a certain assumption and baggage to it, which for a variety of scientific reasons has moved to the individual, with the normal statistical apparatus helping that edifice. And so, to be a little cynical, you get funded by looking at the individual for monitoring and public health kind of things, but then if you want to publish in big journals, you got to merge it with the more rich contextual information. So,
And I think the catch I was mentioned, they are also Native American study. They are school-based, and their experimental unit is on the school, although intervention, you have to be on the physical activity and the dietary intake, you know, on an individual. But the intervention protocol is focused on the school base. And I might share with you that the results, they find there are health benefit effects. But it doesn't sustain. Over years, they just change back. That's one thing. And this happened in our teen study. We do not see any changes in body weight after the intervention, 6 months intervention. But we see their biomarkers greatly improve. They have much better lipid profile. Their glucose level is lower. Their adiponectin is much better. So I just want to share with you.
I'd just like to point out that the PAC in ALSPAC is parents and children, and it was conceived as a study of families. Although it's true, the measures are all at the individual level. And we might think a little bit more about Jeffrey Rose's advice to study the causes of incidence at more of a population level. But at the end of the day, we're still measuring, you know, BMI and that sort of thing on individuals and averaging or looking at distributions in the population. So.
To couple on that point, when thinking about contextual levels, we often aggregate up from the individual. And another aspect, I think, or another dimension of what you might be suggesting is something that was suggested earlier, is thinking about power and how are those individuals aggregated up to the aggregate. And thinking and modeling along those dimensions, we have very sophisticated ways of, for example, even taking individual observations and adjusting for the individual's perception of their environment by aggregating over a number of individuals to obtain a contextual estimate. But more of a consideration of how power influences the aggregation of individuals into more aggregate collectives, I think, might be another way to extend this thinking about if you shift away from the individual.
Didn't want to break your flow of arguments, but in this whole business of individuals versus populations versus families and so on, I mean, clearly, if you look at evolutionary influences, infectious diseases and the lack of nutrition have been two powerful forces in determining population genetic variability. And I just wanted to ask Dr. Laberge, given that he's had a lot of experience in looking at the French-Canadian founder populations and looking at a variety of immigrant groups in Quebec and using tools such as HapMap typing to perhaps separate them or to classify them, I'm just wondering whether there's been any, if there is any progress in looking at those approaches, such as HapMap typing, in sorting out ethnicity, because we know that in the modern world with population migrations and intermarriage and so on, ethnicity per se doesn't necessarily give you a very powerful tool.
Well, the output from the HapMap has now permitted us to place an individual within 100 miles of where he really resides by looking at his genome. So ethnicity will be changing to GPS notification and migration route, and not by boundaries of countries and so on. For example, in Quebec, here, Damien Labuda of St. Justin can separate somebody of Irish origin in Gaspé from somebody from Granby and from Lanaudière and so on because of the number of SNP that you use. You individualize everybody, and then you you connect the haplotypes and figure out where. But people are starting to realize that what you connect is the migration route out of Addis Ababa, 10,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago. In Quebec, for example, Pavel Hamet, using foundry population of Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean, found that the type of fat distribution of their descendant in Montreal was completely different from what it was in Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean. The body shape was completely different. So he's found maybe about 2,500 SNP and maybe 25 or so more significant. He's trying to figure out what the the system and the pathways are. Because you're talking about system biology or system per se. Well, the work of Barabasi since 1999, the network of the E. coli and the OMIM map of diseases and so on, it's the Google experiment, right? You send something and you get some feeling back. Well, biology is a system, and pathways can be derived. You can be and as long as you get the product, whatever way you do, so there's redundancy and so on. And the most complex system is biology and genomics. It's more complex than the universe.
That would be an interesting one.
I think that was Robert Levitt.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Was been trying to talk.
It's not urgent.
No.
I was just going to comment on MAVEN, which I think is ideally suited to deal with heterogeneity at many different levels. The one maybe I'll talk about is adversity per se. My own impression is that if you separate out obesity related to adversity versus obesity that's not, I think there's the potential for very different trajectories of development and pathophysiology in those two groups. And I think there's lots of obesity in both groups. There's lots of obesity in non-adverse populations. There's lots of obesity in adverse populations. Being a psychiatrist, I see a lot of obesity in the context of mood disorders and anxiety disorders. So that's one example of adversity that's perhaps a little different than what we tend to think about. Going back to the issue of birth weight, starting with that as an adversity, the whole thrifty hypothesis is based on the notion that there's maternal signaling of adversity to the fetus, and then that triggers a whole set of gene-environment interactions that go on to produce diabetes and obesity. But one interesting question is what other adversities can do the same thing? So fetal stress is one way that can occur, but are there other ways that intergenerational signals of adversity are passed from generation to generation? Are there critical windows of development? Are there certain ages where adversities are much more likely to trigger obesity and trajectories towards obesity? Are there certain ages where it's less likely to occur? What about the adversities themselves? There's physical adversities in terms of weather patterns, multi-generational effects. There's more emotional adversities in terms of basic emotional development. And so these are all sorts of questions that we can look at with MAVEN because we have, as I mentioned before, we have two different cohorts with different sorts of adversities, one based on the the more physical low birth weight cohort. Then we have the one with maternal depression and anxiety. And we also have the normal controls in each case. So we can answer some of these questions about just adversity versus not, how that affects trajectories. And then within the groups that are adverse, do different adversities have different effects as well? So lots of ways of addressing heterogeneity.
So I'll just go back a little bit to what I was pushing on and say that, first of all, I wasn't trying to be critical of what we heard. I mean, I think it's enormously rich. I'm just trying to push our thinking about our understanding of environment and individual interaction to some extent. And one way to go is to aggregate up. But what if the proximal food environment was the target of our understanding? How would we think about collecting data, and how would we think about layering that within the context of what are the forces that create those proximal food environments that we all get exposed to? We might be thinking, I think that's where the data gaps are going to come from. We're not really going to understand very well. Like, I think about all the data that was presented about different countries and obesity in different countries and the nutrition transition discussion. Do we really understand the environmental component or the things that make those food environments different? We have some kind of big, high-level understanding of it, but if the target is to understand food environments, then we start to ask questions about how trade affects food environments, about how different parts of the food production chain affect those food environments. And we start asking a different set of questions, which would lead to a different kind of set of models than the ones that would maybe more naturally arise out of the data that we've heard about this morning. And again, I'm not trying to be critical. I'm just pushing us to think about those tough questions and also the need we're going to have for data from those levels of thinking and those kinds of things. I think and not surprisingly, the family and the school are the first two places we might go at those levels as target levels because they're natural groups, they're natural ways to kind of target above the individual. But food environments, I don't have the answer of how you can do this easily and get there, but I think we're going to have to think hard about it.
Absolutely, Diane, and I completely agree with you, and that's the new frontier of looking at things really from a multi-level perspective, and I will keep commenting on this in the concluding comment to this morning. But for now, I have my colleague Demetrios here, who is a marketing science modeler. When we look, for instance, at the food environment, you start with the home, you start with community, you start with value chain, you start your market, and so on. And I would like, do you mind, Demetrios, if I call on you? When we talk about the data, the models, there is, when I was saying this morning, the science of the house and finding way to expand upon what you had this morning. This is the state of the art of health and nutrition cohort. And we need, if we don't want to dream, and I will come back with the Quebec societal plans, I'm looking at Rémi here, if we don't want to dream and say, okay, our intervention is to change the world, let's have a completely new data that what is going on now, you will get what Prakash is saying, you get WHO, FAO working with very poor scientific data to do what they do. So I will stop, let Demetrios talk a bit about heterogeneity into consumer, into markets, and the type of stuff that you do in marketing science.
Thanks, Loretta. Thanks for calling me. My esteemed colleague Loretta mentioned, I'm in marketing, so I have to apologize for that beforehand. But I do want to pick up on the comment, though, of the individual level. Coming from a marketing perspective, I do a lot of work on marketing communications, and what we're talking right now in marketing communications is basically one-to-one communications, and communication at the individual level. And it would be interesting to hear the views of our friends here from PepsiCo, for example, that mass communication is a bit on the downside right now, and we have more one-to-one and individual communication because of the internet. And was I forgot who mentioned about differences in countries have become smaller in terms of communication because especially young adults, adolescents, so forth, they have access to the internet. So I am a firm believer that I have, and coming from a statistical background, because my training in statistics, I think we have to build up from the individual level, especially because the communication objectives and the communication goals of marketers, sellers, manufacturers, providers, if you like, and also from a public policy perspective, from public organizations, is more and more on the individual levels. I mean, for example, we're doing some work with the PhD student of mine, and Health Canada has this viral contest, right, where they're trying to sign up more people to the websites and trying to find out, you know, how they respond to the increase their awareness levels for you know, health issues and so forth. So I do believe that yes, I understand that the intervention level could be higher than the individual level, but I think there is room to build up, especially because of communication right now happening both from the public organizations and from sellers, profit organizations, if you like, at the individual level and the individual perspective, and there's a lot of tools that we can use right now. I mean, we've heard some views on that already, and I think I'm looking forward to the afternoon session to do that. And I think the trend is decompose the data as much as possible and then build up from there. And this way we're not going to lose any information on the way. I don't know if that was...
Yeah, and maybe talk a bit, just briefly, about the type of database that are used from a perspective of consumer, retailing, and stuff like this.
First of all, I mean, it was interesting to see that you talked a little bit, Lorette, about the role of sellers, retailers, you know, possible location retailers, and how that can change the behavior of consumers, individuals, dietary behavior, and so forth. And I think we have to move more towards that because that's another sort of intervention as well, right? There were a lot of mentions about the fast food industry or the carbonated beverages. We have standardized products that perceivably, you know, in terms of ingredients, could be of a certain quality, and they're offered at very low prices, and we see that more and more. So the accessibility, the financial accessibility, is higher as well. So we have to look at the individual level, but also we have to look what we call the demand side in economics and in marketing, but we also have to look at the supply side and how the change of the supply side, especially from organizations or manufacturers that actually make that you know, very fast accessible, and again, you know, fast food chains, that's a good example of that, how that has changed the behavior.
Yeah.
See, this is a nice debate is going on, but what I think, there is a huge dichotomy when we are going to tackle this global epidemic of obesity or diabetes or what may be like that. See, these dichotomies are in the policy level. See, if you think that we are talking about the system biology, that means we are taking every piece and putting it together. So you think that we are wondering whether we are having next green revolution. So where we are going to have new food products and geography is constant of Mother Earth, so we will have to do agriculture in the same field. So you are going to generate more and more high energy food. So now you think that all the population are having access to the food, so they will have more of those high energy food. Tell me a single useful component of Coca-Cola or Pepsi. Still, we are having that product, and in the developing country, we are selling them. So if you see the tobacco uses, we know that there is no single useful component of the tobacco, but in many countries, we are having tobacco product, and we are giving subsidies to the farmers. And we are going in the other way, we are telling that stop it. So there is a huge dichotomy. And all of those procedures and protocols where we are seeing is not applicable to different countries. See that it's wonderfully Dimitri was talking about that one-to-one conversation, but it will be very difficult in Asian countries because of the population burden. There we will have to think the intervention in a different level. See that tomorrow I can show you some of the data, hard data with genotypes and phenotype correlation in the teenage obesity in urban India. There is a clear indication that is much more environmental rather than genetics. And in environment, that I have opportunity in one single nucleotide polymorphism mapping of Indian population in the remote corners of Himalayas. I saw that when talking to those district medical officers, they are talking that diabetes, before 25 years, there was not a single case. But now diabetes is coming out, 3%, 4% in that Himalayan region. You imagine that all the houses in the 45 degree angle. So everyday living is a huge exercise. So what is going on? They said that the access to the road and more foods, they are refined foods, refined oil, and they are not getting those, what I will say, those quote-unquote wild type of oil, that homemade oil and other things like that. So this is indirectly this is pointing out this is that lifestyle. What you are talking with the diabetes, because I basically work with the diabetes, we are talking about a phenotype, we are talking about a disease. Maybe this is not a disease. This is an evolutionary stabilization of a phenotype because we are intervening with the mother nature. So much, that's why you are getting this phenotype. Because these people are not dying immediately. So they are stabilizing themselves. So I think that first thing in that whatever Loretta was talking about that intervention, I think if we think in the upside down, intervention should be in the policy level where two ministries are not talking each other.
Thank you. Aysa Narendra, maybe two last comments and then we are already 5 minutes late. Narendra and the last comments.
I just want to compliment what Dr. Bahadurji was saying. To me, it appears, taking point that probably in our kind of environment, both individual are important as well as the communities are important because the policy changes are still occurring. So in India, if Walmart is still not allowed or there is problem, so in a developed society, that is not considered, but as a policy level, that is still to take place. Similarly, in a certain area, a policy brings in rapid industrialization. A new road passes through a certain area and rapid industrialization occurs. Now, that is a policy level where influence will be more macro at community or a family level rather than at individual. But on the other hand, a kind of a marketing expert, when he is or she is trying, it is trying to communicate at individual level. So I think a hybrid of both a sampling unit or an analysis unit has to be taking into account both the factors.
I just, Yong Yun-shin from Virginia Commonwealth University. I just want to point out from an analytical point of view, you never want to aggregate the data to higher level. So the same question has been raised in education literature from, as far as I know, from 1958, Robinson. And this is regarding the contextual effect. When you do this X bar thing, the average within the cluster, what's going to happen is, you are erasing, say, let's say BMI, person-to-person variation, and you are trying to target the cluster-level variation, but that's not what's happening. When you do X-bar, there is a certain measurement error. You are trying to measure the population cluster mean, but X-bar is not going to do that. So when you do this aggregated data and analyze this aggregated data, what's going to happen is that aggregated data is going to carry level one variability to level two, some residual variability. That's going to affect your effect estimator. That's going to be biased so hugely in some cases when the cluster sizes are not large. That is known from the literature.
Great debate to go over lunch between. So, no, I think that I think that there are various schools about aggregation, disaggregation, and this is the type of important scientific issue that have to be discussed and keep discussing around around lunchtime. The lunch is served. Is it the case? I think it's served in the room here. Just two words in conclusion for this morning, because Diane and I, usually we both agree and disagree on everything, and it is the case. If you're back to my presentation at first, where I was talking about this brain-to-society system modeling, and if I'm allowed to come back to this, in terms of food, I think that this notion of observing individual nested within its biology and within it all its level of environment, both what happened between the child and the parent at mealtime, at the school, at the policy level, I think it's extremely important. And the point, so the data, the cohorts that were there this morning are kind of the state-of-the-art major cohorts. And the point I was referring to Rémi Coderre here, who is a colleague from Quebec. We are involved, sponsored by CIHR, by the way, in the Knowledge to Action program with the public health in Montreal and in the province of Quebec. And the societal action plan has 75 actions, agri-food, school, community, and so on. And it's a 40 million over 10 years? Yeah. So, and the question is that there's no room there for, or very little budget has been done for evaluation. You get the surveillance data, Rémi, who is in charge of evaluation at the school and community. I don't know if Lynn Mongeau is here. The surveillance, I think there's no survey with the kids for the next 2 years. So the point is that surveillance data are there. Those solid cohorts are there. And the point now, I think that there is not enough intervention, and we can debate and let the modeler debate on aggregation this afternoon, but I think that there is an effort to be made to try to think how can we link better what the data we have that are out there and the actual multi-level interventions that have to happen. And there, that will bring to data in school, data wherever. And I think that that's very much when we talk about this new frontier of multi-level bridging system science with cross-sectoral data, with this multi-level, I think that that's where, what we are here for.
So we agree or disagree?
We agree 75%. So thank you so much, everybody. Thank you to Alain and Margaret as moderator. And we are 10 minutes, so let's try to be back at 1 o'clock. Bon appétit. So the lunch, I think, is served there.